I'm very excited for the opportunity to speak from you or to you from the story. And what we've been doing is we've been taking the entire Bible and we're teaching the entire Bible as fast as we can. So we are about 9 or 10 weeks into the story. And what it is, it's a collection of 31 significant passages, significant stories out of the Bible in order to give a panorama of what happened from the beginning all the way to the end. And we find ourselves here in 2 Samuel. And so today, all we have before us to cover is the book of 2 Samuel and all 24 chapters. And so I'm excited to do that. I'm hoping, my prayer is that we'll just be able to encounter the story of David. Kurt last week talked about him becoming the king over Israel. And I'm going to pick up from that place, from him becoming king and the days that follow. And so I'm hoping that you'll be intrigued by the story of David. I'm hoping that you're going to be stirred in your heart to read the story of King David in 2 Samuel. I hope that you'll be encouraged to just recognize that God is sovereign over all things, and he's sovereign over his story, the story that he's unfolding. I hope that you'd be inspired by David's zeal, his zeal for God, his zeal for life, his zeal for his role, his zeal for just everything that God's put before him. I also hope that you'll be emboldened pushed towards, like David just has a strong sensitivity to God's ways of doing things. And as you read 2 Samuel, you can't help but notice that he is keenly aware of God's ways. Not that he always follows them. And we're going to encounter some of those times. And I believe that we'll be challenged as a leader in our lives. We're all leaders over those whom God has given us influence over. So I actually want to start in Deuteronomy 17. So if you want to turn there, because God has given Moses way back when a record of a few important things to remember for all these future kings of Israel. So go to Deuteronomy 17. It's kind of like, you know, when you get a new device and you open it up and you pull out all these papers and what does it say? Read this first. I brought some. It's like these. I kind of like projects, I kind of like devices, and so I happen to have a collection of these, and so I wanted to read these to you. So please read carefully and save these instructions as you may need them at a later date. Okay? Right here. Important safety instructions. When using this product, basic precautions should always be followed, including heed all the warnings, including the ones below, and the ones that are written on the product. Warning, read and follow these instructions. There's a risk of fire and a risk of electric shock. All right, better read that, right? I mean, I know you guys read it all. You guys read all these things. And important, read all the instructions before installation and keep this manual near for future reference. All right, and then warning. To reduce the risk of injury, read the instruction manual before operating this pressure washer. Quick setup guide. Hey, that's what we want. The quick setup guide, right? But on the bottom says, warning, this guide is not a substitute for reading the operator's manual. You need to understand the whole manual before reading this, using this product. And that's what we have here in Deuteronomy 17. It says, Deuteronomy 17, we're going to jump to verse, I believe it is, 14. Deuteronomy 14. You guys there? You guys won that time. When you come to the land that the Lord your God is giving you, when you enter the land the Lord your God is giving you and have taken possession of it, that's what they did through Joshua, and you get settled in it, and you say, let us set a king over us like all the other nations around us. Next verse. Be sure to appoint over you the king the Lord your God chooses. He must be from among your own brothers. Don't place a foreigner over you, one who is not a brother Israelite. Next verse, the king, moreover, must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself or make people return to Egypt to get more of them. For the Lord has told you, you are not to go back that way again. Next verse, he must not take many wives, or his heart will be led astray. He must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold. And when he takes the throne of his kingdom, he is to write for himself on a scroll a copy of this law taken from that of the priests who are Levites. Next verse, it is to be with him, and he is to read it all the days of his life, so that he may learn to revere the Lord his God and follow carefully all the words of this law and these decrees. So here we have the instruction manual. And he's told that you need to take this law, this book of most likely Deuteronomy, and you need to just write that down real quick. Jot this down and keep this law next to you in case you might need it for future references, right? So God gave him the read this first. But what we're gonna do is we're going to open up the book of Samuel. We're going to jump in right at 2 Samuel chapter 5 and see what he does the moment that he becomes king of Israel. And he was king over Hebron for a period of days. So jump with me, 2 Samuel. He was king over this area called Judah. But see, Saul, he didn't go down easy, did he? And his commanders and his armies, they kind of wanted to do their own thing, not quite recognizing David as the legitimate king. And so they set up their own king for a time. And for 7 years, Judah was king over this lower area of Judah. And his capital city was Hebron. That's the same place that Abraham's wife was buried. But where we start in 2 Samuel 5 is where finally the Israelites have come and they've submitted themselves to the kingship of David. So this is a really exciting time. I need to get there too. So what we have, the first thing that David decides to do is he decides to go up to Jerusalem. David was 30 years old when he began to reign. He reigned for 40 years after his 7 years in Hebron. And the king and his men went to Jerusalem against the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, who said to David, "You will not come in here. But you know what? The blind and the lame can fight you off." Because they were thinking, there's no way David can come in here. Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion, that is, the city of David. And David said on that day, "Who will strike the Jebusites? Why don't you go in there, fight off the lame and the blind that, you know, that they threatened me against, because this is going to be my city." And so this is really interesting. Why is it that Jerusalem, when did Jerusalem become part of Israel? When did Jerusalem become part of Israel? Back in Genesis 15, God promises Abraham that your descendants, your offspring are going to have this land. And it starts to list all these cities. And it includes Jerusalem in this list. I wanted to ask you guys, what are some of the names associated with this city? Jerusalem. Can you think of any other names? It just gave us one, the city of David, right? Okay, not so much. And it's also called where? The Holy City. It's called Mount Zion. But what about Jebu? Have you ever recognized it as the city called Jebu? See, Joshua led the Israelites into the land and they got it all portioned out. But the thing was, it reads, and it's really shocking because it's the first time we hear anything like this in the allotment. And it says, in Joshua, and it says, Joshua, I have the text, maybe I'll find it. And it says, now, Judah couldn't get the Jebusites out of Jerusalem. So they just kind of stayed there and dwelt along with the Israelites. And that was kind of shocking to read, Joshua 15:63. And the thing was, here, they're going up against the Jebusites in this fortified city, and they fortified it so well that they like, there's no way anybody's getting in here. And it says in 2 Chronicles 11, it says, David says to his men, "Hey, whoever gets in there first, they get to be the chief, the commander-in-chief over the armies of Israel. And so this guy, Joab, he's like, I'm going in. And so he goes in through the water shaft of Jebu and goes over to the gates and opens the gates. And the Israelites, David and his men, march in and conquer the stronghold of Jerusalem. And in that stronghold place, that's where he lived. And that's where it says he became called the City of David and Mount Zion. And I have some more questions that I want to ask you. Is this place significant? It's immensely significant. I don't think we could talk about the story without talking about the land as almost like a character that God was promising to Israel. And then within that land, there's this specific city that God just seems to focus in on. I mean, it's so significant. If you read like Revelations 21, it says, then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride for her husband. The city's just lavishly decorated. I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the dwelling place of God is with man, and he will dwell with them, and he will be his people. And God himself will be with them as their God. And he'll wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning or crying or pain, for the former things have passed away. This is the big hope, the big climactic final scene, the new Jerusalem, Mount Zion, coming down from heaven. And it says, Jesus, who is seated on the throne, it says, behold, I am making all things new. Write these words down. And he said, it is done. I am the Alpha, the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give from the spring of the water of life. The one who conquers will have this heritage, and I will be his God, and he will be my son. And there's more. It describes the city that's coming down and describes the gates and all the jewels and the streets, and it describes everything. This is God's city. So, was there a temple in the city when David conquered it? No, there was no temple in the city when David conquered it. And that's pretty interesting. We're going to come back to that. And the very next chapter, we're going to move along, chapter 6. And so now that David is finally in his city, he's like in this cedar palace that he kind of like took over. And of course, they built it up and made it nice. God provided some lumber. And he's like, you know, I think we should bring the Ark of God to this place. This is a good place. So they go out and they start to bring the Ark of God. Well, the thing was, David forgot to read the instructions. And they make this ark, this like cart to carry the Ark of God into Jerusalem. And you read that story there, and they do it the wrong way. And people die on account of it. And there's like this setback, and David's like, what is going on? And basically, God's presence is manifested at this Ark of the Covenant. This is what was in the temple in the most holy of holies. God chose to have his presence be there. And that's where it went around. Like, it would end up in people's house. Like, they got conquered, and it like ruined the lives of the Philistines who like captured the Ark. And then like it got left here at this one guy's house, and like his whole house was blessed because God's presence on this Ark remained. And he just blessed them. And David was like, all right, let's just bring this into Jerusalem. But what we see in this story is him dancing and him worshiping. He's just so excited about God's presence. He's so excited about who God is, and you can't escape that from him. He has such a zeal and a love and an admiration from God, and you see it in this story right here. And so then he's, chapter 7, he's sitting there in his house, and he's like, I got a nice house. But the Ark of God is just sitting here in a tent. He pitched a tent, and that's where the Ark of God. He's like, this isn't right. This doesn't feel right. And so he begins to grow in him these plans and this desire to build a house for the Ark. And so there was no temple in Jerusalem when they took it over. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that. I mean, yeah, we're going to talk more about that. So chapter 7, I know you guys are moving right along and you got this all down. So he's sitting in his palace and he receives word back from God that, hey, you're not the guy. You're not going to build me a palace. But some super, super significant things happen in this encounter with God. Promises that just last forever and point to a forever king. A king that will sit on the throne from David's lineage, and his kingdom will last forever. This has never been said before. Yes, God promised to Abraham that he would have descendants that were so numerous and that they'd be a blessing to all the nations. But, you know, and all this stuff unfolded where it's just like, when's that going to happen? Who's that guy? And then David gets this promise and it's like, I'm going to establish your house forever, and there will be a kingdom that is established forever. And it points to the future coming of Jesus. And in fact, the verses here from 2 Samuel 7 are used in Acts to describe who Jesus is, using these same covenant promises. In fact, Jesus is, we'll find out, that the forever king and over the forever kingdom. And so don't miss that when you're reading 2 Samuel this week. So I wanted to read for you real quick out of Psalm chapter 2. And actually, you know what? Let's skip Psalm 2. Psalm 2 is a good one. Write that down. Let's go to Psalm 89. And if you can get there, good for you. Psalm 89, verse 26. These are words that God promises, but this is David's psalm. It says, David, he shall cry to me, you are my Father, my God, the rock of salvation. And I will make him the firstborn, the highest of the kings of the earth. And then we start to realize, wait, he's not talking just about David. He's pointing to this forever king, this future king. And my steadfast love, I will keep him forever. And my covenant will stand firm for him. I will establish his offspring forever, and his throne as the days of the heavens. Isn't that cool? Back to verse 2 of 89. For I said, steadfast love will be built up forever in the heavens. You will establish your faithfulness. You have said, I have made you a covenant with my chosen one. I have sworn to David my servant, I will establish your offspring forever and build your throne for all generations. And so it's quite a significant moment in Israel's history and our own history, the grand story of God bringing about his people and his kingdom and restoring things for all time and our future promise. But let's move on. So if we can move on to chapter 11. Lots of things happen. Chapter 8, wars, victories, plunder, and fame. In chapter 9, David decides to honor Saul's son, Jonathan, by giving Mephibosheth just a place at his table. And chapter 10, he tries to honor some other guys, the Ammonites, but David is misunderstood, and they kind of end up bringing about their own worst fear. But in chapter 11, if you've gotten there, we encounter David sitting on his couch. Let's join David on his couch. And the Lord sent, let's go to 2 Samuel 11. It says, in the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. They destroyed the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah. But David remained in Jerusalem. Dun, dun, dun. Next sentence. One evening, David got up from his bed and walked around on the roof of his palace. From the roof, he saw a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful. And David sent someone to find out about her. The man said, "Isn't this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" Then David sent messengers to get her. She came to him, and he slept with her. She had purified herself from her uncleanness. Then she went back home. The woman conceived and sent word to David, saying, "I am pregnant." Next verse. I'm reading off of your slides, because I have the ESV, and I don't want to confuse everybody. So David sent this word to Joab, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." And Joab sent him to David. Next verse. When Uriah came to him, David asked him how Joab was, how the soldiers were, and how the war was going. And next, then David said to Uriah, "Go down to your house, wash your feet." So Uriah left the palace as a gift from the king, and a gift was from the king was sent after him. And as you read along, he does this terrible thing, and he lusts after this woman. He calls her into his house. He sleeps with her, and then he tries to cover it up. He tries to bring in Uriah and just like, "Hey, why don't you go home? Why don't you just go home?" And so there'd be some confusion about whose child this was. And as it goes on, Uriah just refused to go in. He's like, "No, listen. My fellow kinsmen are out there on the battlefield sleeping in the open sky. There's no way I'm going to go home and just sleep, you know, and be with my wife." And David's like, "Come on, just stay a couple days." He tried to get him drunk and make him go, and Uriah just doesn't do it. So in the end, David's like, "Well, what am I going to do?" So he writes a letter to Joab, and he decides, "Well, hey, I'll just send it with Uriah." So Uriah's got this letter in his hand that basically is his death sentence, and, you know, with the seal on it, so I guess he couldn't open it or something like that, right? It's just too bad he didn't, like, look at it. Maybe I better not pass this on. But Uriah does what he's supposed to, and it's told Joab to put him in the front so that he gets killed. You know, so he's walking back to the battle lines, having this weird, "I don't know why David called me in here," and, you know, all, whatever that was. He's clueless, but he's got this letter, sends it, and that's his death sentence. And it says, but this thing, if you go to the end of that verse, verse 27, Bathsheba ended up coming in. She grieves over her husband and comes in and lives in the palace with David. When the mourning was over for her husband, David sent and brought her into his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. And what's crazy is Nathan comes and he tells this story that totally just shames David and brings him to the place of like, "I realize that I'm caught." It's like he thought that he could get away with it. It's like he tried to put it behind him. He tried to cover it up, and he thought that that was going to be okay. But we've seen it's just not true, and that's such the case with sin. We always think that we're just going to engage and then be done with it. But sin's not like that. Sin always takes us deeper than we wanted to go. Sin always holds us longer than we wanted to stay. And sin always affects more people than you wanted it to affect. It takes you deeper, it holds you longer, and it affects more than you wanted it to. So he gets word from Nathan. Verse 10 of chapter 12. "Now, therefore, the sword shall never depart from your house, because you have despised me and have taken you the wife of Uriah to be your wife." And so he promises David that you're just going to have you have a mess on your hands, and you're going to continue to have a mess on your hand. I don't think the mess started then, because we see in 2 Samuel, way back when he was in Jerusalem, if you read that, you're like, "Dude, what is with David and all these wives?" Like, he's like, "Yeah, he married this girl, and they just had sons and daughters, and then he had, you know, a few more wives when he moved to this." It's like everywhere he went, he just got a few more wives and kids. And it's like, "Well, what's the deal? How is this so?" Well, and like, doesn't God say anything about this? He didn't read the instruction manual. Right? Because it said, don't accumulate a bunch of wives for yourself. God does speak about this. And it is not what God wants. So he's got a mess on his hands in his household. David's leadership has affected the quality of life in his house. I want to move along. There's a lot of crazy things that happen. The very next chapter, we start to hear about Absalom. Absalom is the son of David. And over the next several chapters, from 13 to 17, you hear about Absalom, and he takes revenge on somebody that sinned against him. But he killed one of David's other sons, and he goes into exile. And he's in exile for a period of time until he's called to come back. And he ends up returning to where David was in Jerusalem. But then right after that, he creates this conspiracy. It's like he's just, I don't know why he decides to do this. But he basically goes out and he sits at the city gates. And when any of the Israelites come in to get their questions dealt with, to resolve issues of like whether land disputes or, you know, any legal matters, Absalom, it says, he won over the hearts of the Israelites. He said, King David, he hasn't really set up anybody to deal with that for you. You just come to me. You come to me and I'll take care of you. It's like the Godfather or something. I'll take care of you. And so he does this, and this is his conspiracy, and he ends up wooing all the people who were supposed to be under David's leadership. And he ends up raising up an army, and they actually go to fight against Jerusalem's men. And he ends up, Absalom, dying in battle. And David just grieves, like almost like over-the-top grieving. That's part of his zeal. It seems like he's just always there. He's always ready to experience life. He's always just so present, whether it's, and he might think he sounds emotional, but like he's very emotional, but he grieves when God grieves. He has sorrow when God is sorry, and he rejoices when God is doing amazing things. He's just sensitive to God's ways, and he experiences them just deeply, whether it's joy or sorrow. And so he grieves, but like Joab's like, and it says like all the guys who just were out in this battle, they come in and it says they like stole into the city as those who have been defeated. They won the battle, they conquered, but they walk in defeated because the king is weeping and wailing and mourning and grieving. And we see the people all just experiencing the same thing that their leader is experiencing. So eventually David returns to Jerusalem. I mean, it was such a sad day, the day that they heard that Absalom's going to come and try to, you know, kill David. And they left in haste. They left so fast. And they all decided to leave this fortified area, and they're going to go out towards the wilderness. And this is not a good thing, and I'm not even sure they needed to go. It's like David just got scared. He just left in haste, and he stopped at the last house, and all the people of his house came by him as he stood there, and it just says he was at this house, and they're all just like weeping and wailing and in mourning again. And we just see this over and over, that the people do what the leader's doing. And I think that's pretty interesting. The people always seem to be impacted by their leaders. So in chapter 19, he ends up going back to Jerusalem, and there's this crazy guy, Sheba. And I really like this crazy story about Sheba because it just, to me, I'm just exploring the idea of leadership. Here's David, a leader over his people, and Sheba, he's like, you know what? We don't got anything. He actually, he's like a significant guy because he has access to the trumpet. You know what? We don't have anything. Everybody should go home. It was probably a little bit more selfish motives than that. I think he actually wanted people to kind of like follow him. But what he says, he just, have you ever been around somebody who's just like, my daughter has a book. It's about the pout fish. And this fish has a big pouty face. And it's like a big frown. And He says, I'm a pout-pout fish with a pout-pout face, and I spread the dreary wearies all over the place. Blub, blub, blub. And that's this guy. And the story's kind of cool, and when my mom tells it, it's the best. My daughter loves it. But that's the thing. They just kind of spread their discontent, or they spread their fear, or they spread around all the problems associated with a thing. And we just love being around those people, you know. But like David's like, this is not okay. This is not okay. And it says this guy, he ended up going all the way through like all the tribes of Israel, all the Israelites, not the Judah down south, but all the Israelites. And they all go back to their tents. They all go back to their tents with the dreary wearies. And I'm just starting to notice some themes as I'm reading through that. And it has to do with leadership, and it has to do with the people that follow the leader. And there's such a strong relationship. And so I just want to explore that a little more. In chapter 21, we have David and the Giants, part 2. I don't know if you guys knew this. You should turn to it. 2 Samuel 21. And it says that there was war again against the Philistines. See, David fought against the Philistines when he was a young boy before he was king. And David and he came out against a guy named Goliath, right? You guys, Kurt mentioned that story last week, but he didn't get to go into detail in it. So we're going to get Goliath part 2. There was war again between the Philistines and Israel. So David went down with his servants, and they fought against the Philistines. But David, he got tired. In fact, there was a guy that was Ishbi-Benob. He was one of the descendants of the giants, and his spear, it weighed 300 shekels of bronze. And I didn't research how much that is. Your Bible probably has a footnote. And he was armed with a brand new sword, and he was going to kill David. And a guy steps in, and he saves David at the final moment, and he kills the giant. Whoa. So what's next? That's Abishai, came to the rescue. Then David's men swore to him, hey, never again will you go out with us to battle so that the lamp of Israel will not be extinguished. Next verse. So then, in the course of time, there was another battle with the Philistines at Gob. And at that time, that guy, he killed Saph, one of the descendants, another giant. And so next, in another battle with the Philistines at Gob, that guy, he killed Goliath the Gittite, who had a spear with a shaft like a weaver's rod, another giant. And then I want to stop for a second because it's just interesting about this next guy. This next guy, he comes out, and this is, it says, he's a man of great stature. I mean, Goliath was 9 feet tall or something like that, and this guy, I don't know, he might have been like, he seemed like extra big. I mean, this guy, he had 6 fingers on each hand, right? He had 6 toes on each foot. I mean, if you need 6 toes in order to be able to stand up straight, I mean, you got to be a big guy, right? I don't know why he had so many fingers and so many toes, but the Bible tells us that he does, so it's interesting to me. And he's big. And he goes out, and he's like, where did he come out? I think it was Gath, right? He took place at Gath, and that's exactly where Goliath is from. And he comes out, and he taunts Israel. Remember what Goliath was saying to Israel? Who are you? You come at me with sticks and stones to defeat me, Goliath. You know, you have nothing. What am I, a dog? You come at me with sticks, and you know, like all these things. He's taunting Israel. And this one guy, he stands there, and if he's dead, they win the war, right? That's what the champions do. The whole army lines up. One guy comes to stand for it, and he says, you take me down, you got everything, you know? And so he has this face off. And before, the Israelites, they were terrified. Saul was terrified of the idea that I've got to fight Goliath. And the Israelites were retreated from it. But David, he just says, you know what? I come at you in the name of God. And so here we have this guy taunting Israel, and Jonathan, the son of Shimea, David's brother, killed him. Boom, done. hey, that's David's nephew, right? And I see it again. It's like the things that leaders do by faith, it's like the people behind them, they just do it. Almost like it's like nothing anymore. What was such a huge thing at first, when a leader leads by faith, the people are able to follow along, almost like in the wake behind a boat. You know what I mean? Where it's like if you're up in front, you know, and everything's like, whoa, look at those waves. And you're in the back, and you're like, there's nothing. I can ski on this. The people get to follow along in that wake and live in the legacy of the leader who leads by faith. And if you read Luke, and I will, chapter 6, verse 40, you hear Jesus say something like this, as if to say, this is the way it should be. A disciple is not above his teacher, but when anyone is fully trained, he will be like his teacher. And the people learn from the leaders and do what the leaders do. So I want us to move along. We're going to go to the end, the very last chapter of 2 Samuel, because something crazy happens here in David's life. So I'd like to jump to the very last verse of 2 Samuel 24, and it says, so the Lord responded to the plea for the land, and the plague was averted from Israel. The plague was averted from Israel. What plague? Why was there a plague? Okay, so I read back a little further. I did this. It's so fun. You should do it. You should read 2 Samuel backwards. It's so interesting. Because I'm like, why was there a plague? And then it says, okay, David built there an altar to the Lord and burnt offerings and peace offerings. So the Lord responded to the plea for the land. Okay, And then you just start reading the backstory, which really comes, you know, straightforward at us. But when you get all the way back, David chose a plague. David's like, yeah, I think let's go ahead and have a plague. And you're like, what? Why would he choose a plague? Well, the thing was, he only had three choices. The prophet came to him and said, okay, you have three choices. You can either have a plague, or we could have a famine for 3 years, or your enemies are going to pursue you for 3 months and defeat all the people, you know, with you. Which one do you choose? Okay, he chooses the plague, and 70,000 people die. But why did he have to make this choice? Well, it goes back to a sin he committed, something that he did that was wrong, something that we can investigate and somewhat speculate, like what was so bad about what David did? Well, what he did is he decided to tell his commanders to go out and have a census. I want you to count up all the people. We do censuses, right? I mean, it doesn't seem, I don't know. What did it mean then? Well, Joab seemed to know. Joab was his commander. He's like, don't do this. He's like, you know what? Whatever that number is, I pray that you'd have 10 times that number. But don't do this. And he says, don't delight in this thing. But it says David's words overpowered. And so they went out and they counted them up and they came back and they said, well, hey, here's the results. And the only thing we have recorded is that the results said, you have 8,000 men in Israel who can take up arms, valiant men. And in Judah down below, you have 500,000 men. David, as soon as he ordered and he heard that word, he immediately felt ashamed. He knew that he did something wrong. And there's Psalms that talk about it. It says, you know, some trust in chariots, some trust in horses, but we trust in the name of the Lord our God. And so what it comes down to, it's like, well, why did David do this? Why did he delight in this? Why did he need to know how many men could take up arms in his army? Was he afraid? Was he just full of pride? He just wanted to know the number? And I don't think that we get the specific answer. But it's got to be one of those things, because we know that he was taking delight in the number of men. And he was putting confidence in how strong he felt he was at this latter part of his life. And this was not okay. And in fact, God had to punish this thing. And so he sends a prophet, Gad, and he says, all right, what you did's not good. You get a choice here. So 70,000 men die. And it talks about what's crazy, and I'm going somewhere with this, is something so powerful happens at the end of this story, and it's just kind of like you could easily miss it. It's weird. So there, at this angel of destruction was going through from up top over on the eastern seaboard or along the Mediterranean, is what I meant, and all the way down to Beersheba. And he's just like wiping out with the plague, but it says there's an angel that's like doing this destruction. And it says, maybe we can read it. When the angel, verse 16, the angel stretched out his hand towards Jerusalem to destroy it. So all of a sudden the angel's there, and he's up at Jerusalem, but he's not just like at David's, like where in Jerusalem was he? That this is interesting. And he says, I saw the angel. He was by the threshing floor of this guy, the Jebusite. And David spoke to the Lord. He saw the angel ready to do this thing, and he spoke to the Lord. And he's like, behold, I have sinned. I've sinned. I've done wickedly. But these sheep, what have they done? Please let your hand be against me and my father's house. So Gad comes up to him and he says, here's what you need to do. You need to go up. You need to go up to this threshing floor, and you need to build an altar, and you need to offer a burnt offering and a sacrifice and a peace offering on this altar. And he's like, okay, I'll do it. So he starts up with his men, and he's walking up the hill, and the guy who owns the land sees it, and he's like, whoa, yikes. So he's coming down towards them. He's like, what is it? He like bows, you know, he's like, what is it, my king? You know, and he's like, I gotta build an altar, and I need to make the sacrifice on your land. And the guy's like, hey, go ahead. Here's some oxen, here's some wood, do what you want. Go ahead, do everything you need to do. And he's like, no, I need to buy this. I need to pay for this. Seriously, you can just have it. No, I need to pay for it. And so he decides to buy this area of land. And he goes up and he builds this altar. And he offers these sacrifices. And it says, and then the Lord responded to the plea for the land, and the plague was averted. What's interesting is that for the first time, Jerusalem, that city, encompassed this area on top of a hill. And this area, this threshing floor, where this angel with all of God's authority, all of his wrath, all of his power was just ready to wipe out whoever would fall by the sword. David has to build this altar. It's the same place where Solomon eventually builds the temple. Solomon builds his temple there, where for years and years after, if you wanted to come clean before God, if you wanted to deal with God, you came to this place and you offered a burnt offering. You offered a sacrifice so that you could have access, so that you could be made right, so that you could worship. Well, in Genesis, Abraham climbs this same mountain, one of the mountains in Moriah. God says, I'll show you what mountain. You just start heading to Moriah, I'll show you what mountain. I've got it all figured out. And he takes his son Isaac, and he says, God's going to provide a lamb here. And he goes to offer this sacrifice on the same mountain. And God says, no, stop, Abraham, don't do it, because I have a lamb. I have a lamb for you. And Abraham offers the lamb that God provided. And I just think it's incredible that in this part of the story we have David coming into Jerusalem and owning it, and then buying this piece of property, which just becomes the place. I mean, you can go there today. My wife's actually stood there. She stood right at this place It's called the Dome of the Rock now. The Muslims have control over it. And you can actually touch, you know, this area, this rock. My wife said, you can't look at it because it's covered up, but you can stick your hand down there and feel it. It's just weird. I don't know. But it's super significant. And here it is. This is where it happens. David, needing to come clean before God, goes to this place, buys this piece of property, and it becomes the site where the temple will be built. Stay tuned. That will be next week. So I want to close today with a story, if you will. But before I get there, I just want to note, David wanted to keep it in-house. I'm the one that sinned. It's my deal. Punish me. And David has this heart for the sheep. It's not them. It's not their fault. But sin always takes you deeper than you wanted to go. It keeps you longer than you wanted to stay. And it affects more people than you wanted it to affect. And so we see the people suffer for the failures of the leaders, for his lack of faith, for his pride, or was it his fear? The people suffer. So, we've seen that relationship unfold throughout the narrative. So what do we learn about being a leader? What do we learn about being a person that somebody follows? Because the thing is, you're a leader. God has given you influence over people. My story that I wanted to close with is this. I was eating eggs. And my daughters were there eating eggs with me. My wife had made them. Our microwave was about to blow up, so we decided to cook them in a pan. And there was all this brown stuff that gets associated with the eggs as they kind of burn a little bit when you do them in a pan. And so they were sitting... What? Brown. My wife wanted to make sure, if you're listening to this in posterity, that it wasn't burnt. The eggs were not burnt. They had brown pieces. And but you ask my daughter, Jordan... She was just, you know, starting to eat. But Hannah, she was digging in. My daughter, she's an eater, and she loves, and she was just digging on these eggs. And my daughter, Jordan's like, hey, I don't think I like these brown things. And she started like, ugh, ugh, what are these brown things? Ugh. And I look at her, and I just, like, they're part of the, you know, whatever. And then Hannah's like, ugh, ew, ugh. And she starts making all these noises. I'm like, Jordan, you're on a timeout. And so she goes over there to sit in her timeout spot, and I say, I want you to tell yourself, Jordan, while you're sitting there, my name is Jordan, and I'm a leader. So I don't know. I didn't necessarily need her to say it out loud a bunch of times, but I want you to say that. And so at the end of her timeout, I call her over, and I say, Jordan, what did I tell you to say? She said, I'm Jordan, and I'm a leader. And I said, well, what does that mean? What do I mean? What does it mean to say that you're a leader? She said, without any prompting from me, people will do what I do. So let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you for David. Lord, you said he's a man after your own heart, and so we have so much to learn from him. I pray that you'd be honored and glorified, Lord, as we seek to emulate the strengths that he has, as we seek to resist some of his weaknesses, Lord. But I pray most of all, Lord, that we would just be in awe of your story and what you are unfolding and how you do that. God, I just ask that that we could take to heart some of the leadership lessons, God, that can arise from this story of David and his being king. In your name we pray. Amen.